Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. Signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's May the 6th, 2010. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
Rising of the moon, there beside the singing river, that dark mass of men were seen, far above their shining weapons on their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune, and hurrah, my boys, for freedom, 'tis the rising of the moon.
I've received a number of requests to comment on the attempted car bombing in New York earlier this week, but I'm not quite sure what to make of that. It hasn't played out yet. The authorities don't seem to be able to get their stories straight. There's definitely something funny going on there. The Pakistan Taliban allegedly claimed responsibility, and they've taken this opportunity to reveal to the world that one of their leaders that Joe Biden claimed was killed a few months ago by predator drones out in the mountains someplace is in fact still alive. So that's one more bit of egg dripping off America's face as regards our endless wars of occupation in the Muslim world trying to grab all the crude oil reserves and protect Israel's ass. Now, as I begin to work on this podcast this morning, which is Tuesday, May the 4th, it seems that some weirded-out Muslim kid has allegedly confessed to loading the SUV up with homemade fireworks or whatever. He said his house was foreclosed on, and he was upset about the Arizona immigration law. It also seems that he's quite Americanized, and he is in fact a registered Democrat and an Obama supporter, although I'm sure that fact will quietly drop off the radar in double-quick time. It may be just some raghead kook, but I still want to see how it plays out and what kind of spin they're going to put on it. However, before this Muslim kid rocked up, there appears to have been a serious move afoot on the part of the media and possibly on the part of the regime to try and blame this incident on the Tea Party people. The authorities broadcast a video they pulled off one of the spy cameras, which have become a feature of our big cities, and the video shows a middle-aged white man who is committing the awful and suspicious act of changing his shirt in the middle of the street in what the media claims is a quote-unquote furtive manner. I'm not sure exactly how anything one does in the middle of a crowded pedestrian mall with hundreds of people around can possibly be furtive, but hey, these smart media people did go to college and all, so I guess in their universe that must make sense. So, why are they trying to blame this on the Tea Party? One of the things you need to realize about our wonderful two-party system is that whereas back when I was coming up it used to be all very much a gentleman's club of Tweedledum and Tweedledee, the establishment is no longer monolithic. It is vitally important that we white nationalists understand this. Over the past 20 years or so, a genuine element of real animosity and conflict has grown up between the Republicans and the Democrats, or more accurately, between the liberal intelligentsia and the big business moneyed corporate interests. Like all conflicts, this is basically economic, as in who gets the biggest part of what pie, but there's also political power involved, of course, which in this society is irrevocably tied in with money, and the control of the American tax revenue, the largest source of wealth in the world. The point I'm making is that the overgrown children who rule us can no longer play nice, as the pie grows ever smaller and the squabbles over who gets what cut grow more and more strident. There is now a genuine hatred, fear, and loathing between liberals and conservatives, and we can use this to our advantage. This genuine hatred explains the recent silly attempts on the part of the liberal media to demonize people like Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh as violent revolutionaries when in fact they're part and parcel of the establishment. Glenn Beck and Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh would no more dream of trying to overthrow the system than they would want to fly to the moon. Why would these slick media operatives want to change a system that's made them millionaires? Even more ridiculously, the liberal media are attempting to call the Tea Party people racists and violent, which they are neither. You look at some of these Tea Party rallies and you see all these pot-bellied middle-aged men and blue-haired old ladies waving the very red, white, and blue flag of the regime that's using them all as teats to be milked. The very idea of them being violent revolutionaries or planting bombs or putting together South American-style right-wing death squads is absurd. But then liberals have always been completely lacking in any sense of the absurd or even any sense of reality. The liberals have simply become so fanatically intolerant and enraged by their failure to bring about the age of Aquarius like they thought they were going to do back in the 60s that they go into hysterics over any opposition or criticism whatsoever, especially from the hated white people. That's why Beck and Limbaugh and Hannity enrage the PC establishment so much, not because they're any kind of physical threat, but because they will not shut up and bow down to pseudo-intellectuals like Arianna Huffington and Jon Stewart and political gangsters like Rahm Emanuel and Barry Satoro. You have to understand that these Jews and leftists who run things now under Obongo genuinely believe that they are better than anybody else. And any argument from us pale peons or refusal on our part to defer to them and accept their natural superiority and their authority sends them into a rage. The Tea Party people are almost all true conservatives in that they don't give a damn about their race. All they care about is their money. They simply don't want to pay taxes, and they most assuredly don't want to pay taxes so that their wealth can be redistributed among blacks and illegal aliens in the form of free health care and government benefits to which they themselves can't get access. It's the old story of the haves versus the have-nots, and white people are increasingly becoming the have-nots. Race is very much starting to come to the surface here in this whole Tea Party thing. I mean, it's become so obvious a factor in everything that there's no longer any way it can continue to be ignored. But these attempts by the liberals and the Democrats to blame the Tea Party for so-called acts of violence and call them racist will backfire on them. To be sure, a few of the Tea Partiers will go running and hiding under the bed rather than be called racist and violent and un-American, but I think that a lot of these people will come to understand that their adherence to democracy and their playing within the system is getting them nowhere. White people's role in the scheme of democracy is to play by the rules, make their protest in due form, then to be ignored, and then to pay up and shut up. I think at some point your typical Tea Party guy will finally say to himself, what the hell, if we're going to do the time, we might as well do the crime. In other words, if, as it appears, we are never, ever going to get a fair shake from these assholes in the media and in the Democratic regime, if any white person who protests and tries to argue is simply going to be slandered and slimed and shouted down every time we open our mouths, if we're going to be accused of being racist by the Democrats and the media no matter what we do, we might as well come right out and be racist. The Tea Party tried playing by the rules, and all that got them was to be spat upon by the media, so to hell with it. Let's start talking about the elephant in the parlor that everyone has been too afraid to talk about before this. Let's talk about race. And once that process begins, once race becomes speakable again after 70 years, that's our camel's nose under the tent, so to speak. Boy, I really got away from the New York truck bomb, didn't I? Okay, let's see if I can wrestle myself to the floor, stop the rambling, and get to a proper question. Dear Harold, may I suggest that you point out that the NAR will not have any Verdammte traffic cameras? People absolutely hate those things. Signed, Dave in California. True, Dave. Right now, there are closed-circuit TVs all over Great Britain, and that's increasingly the case here in the United States. In the UK, some of the cameras are interactive. In other words, you can be walking down the street or through a shopping mall, and you drop a candy wrapper or something, and some cop sitting in a control room 20 miles away yells at you to pick it up. In some parts of Great Britain, it is illegal to put out your garbage for pickup in black plastic bags, because that's racist. You have to use white bags. And no, I'm not making that up. These closed-circuit spy cameras will monitor what color your garbage bags are and report you and fine you, or for all I know, maybe even arrest someone who uses a black garbage bag. Great Britain today has turned into the Airstrip 1 of Orwell's 1984, and I honestly don't know how the Brits can stand living like that. I lived in London myself for a while in the 1980s and again in the early 1990s, and it was beginning then. But today I couldn't stand being under surveillance all the time by Big Brother. There's a whole sort of professional class of camera spies that has appeared in Britain right now. They're not cops as such, but they do nothing all day except sit behind TV screens and watch the cameras and spy on people. There has to be something mentally wrong with people who will do that for a living, just like there's something mentally wrong with FBI and DHS agents who monitor dissident groups like the Northwest Front. Yeah, I know, they're out there listening to me right now. Morris Dees and Mark Potok, I don't mind. They're Jews and they're incapable of moral behavior. I don't expect anything else from them. But I know that there are some kind of federal agents listening to this podcast as well, seeking anything they can to fabricate into some kind of bogus crime so that they can silence a critic of the regime they serve. That is exactly what is not supposed to happen in America. But they don't give a damn so long as their paycheck is direct deposited on time every month. Whoever you federal spies are, you damn well ought to be ashamed of yourselves. Not only do you need a refresher course in the history of this country and its Constitution and Bill of Rights, which you see fit to ignore for money, but I have to tell you, guys or gals from the FBI or Secret Service or DHS or whatever, there is something seriously wrong in your mind. You spy on other people who are exercising rights they're supposed to be born with a view towards doing those people harm, denying them their rights, denying them their humanity, and destroying their lives. That's not just wicked, it's sick and twisted. Seriously, all you guys and bitches in the power suits with badges who are listening to this, do you never actually stop to think what you're doing? Are you genuinely so depraved, so morally denatured, so in love with that pay statement you get off your direct deposit every month that you don't realize that what you are doing here is a breach of human decency? Do you people, honest to God, have no shame? Never mind, we both know the answer to that. Anyway, getting back to Dave's question, not only will there not be closed-circuit TV on every corner in the Northwest American Republic, but as far as I'm concerned, there won't even be any driver's licenses. Oh, sure, I think there need to be a few simple traffic rules that are generally understood, like everybody drives on the right-hand side of the road, and driver's education and safe and responsible driving needs to be taught to kids in high school, but a driver's license is really nothing more than a form of ID so the police know where to find you. You can either drive or you can't, and if you drive drunk and have an accident and kill somebody, you need to be held responsible. But there's no need for a licensing system any more than there was any need in the Old West for a man to have a license to ride a horse. Now, that's my view of the matter anyway. Next question, or rather comment, I should say. This is from Charles in Seattle. Dear HAC, I'm enclosing an article off the internet which I think you should emphasize with prospective migrants. The article is as follows. The headline reads, Seattle named one of 10 future boom towns, and it's dated Tuesday, April the 27th, 2010. The business management BNET website has named Seattle one of 10 cities it predicts will lead the nation in job growth. According to BNET, Seattle is one of 10 boom towns, including towns like Austin, Raleigh, and Minneapolis, that will see rapid growth in communications, IT, and biotech over the next 10 years, as well as recovering from slumps in aerospace and forestry. Let's hope they're right. Signed, Charles. Yes, Charles, I think they are right, at least insofar as we're concerned. The system seems to have an almost magical ability to stabilize itself, except every few years it stabilizes at a lower and lower level. The overall national unemployment rate will probably remain at an official 10% for a long time, and of course higher in real life, but then we're not trying to solve the entire unemployment problem for the whole USA. We're talking about getting a few jobs for our own people in one area of the Pacific Northwest. And that's very much within the realm of possibility. Let me repeat what I've said before. You can get a job here in the Northwest, pretty much anywhere in the Northwest you want, if you will follow a few simple rules or protocols, many of which are the same as you would use anywhere. Is it going to be hard? In view of the Obama Depression, yes, just like it'll be hard anywhere. But if you will stay focused and come with a plan, it can be done. The first thing you have to understand is that nobody is going to give you anything. The party can't give you anything material. The time may come when that changes, and when it does, we will not stint. But that time is not yet and will not be for a long time. You will have to plan your move for about a year in advance. You will have to actively seek employment on the internet and by phone and through other long-distance techniques. You will have to seriously save your money so that you come here with some cash in your pocket, enough to acquire housing when you get here, and to live for as long a time as you can manage prior to obtaining employment. Now, the party can give you a certain amount of practical help, like finding storage facilities and providing crucial contacts on this end, but three things we cannot give you: money, housing, or a job. Arranging those is your end of the deal. A very good way to accelerate your savings program is to forego the use of costly alcohol and tobacco, at least until you get settled in here in the homeland. And yes, regarding my own use of a pipe, I agree that's a tad hypocritical on my part. All I can tell you is that when you're trying to save money for something, $8 to $10 for a six-pack and $12 to $15 for cigarettes every day can mount up. Now, regarding the t-shirt youth, the young men with nothing but the t-shirts on their backs and very limited skills, it helps, really helps, if you have assets to bring here, but it's not necessary. You can make a po' boys migration, although you'll still have to save up a couple of grand. It helps, really helps, if you didn't go for some useless academic or ornamental degree like political science or philosophy or English literature that suits you only for a teaching position, which you'll most likely never get because the NEA is the biggest Democratic patronage union in the country, and you have to be black, brown, perverted, or PC to become a teacher nowadays in most places. But you can still get work if you're willing to turn your hand to anything. It really helps if you didn't dick off in school and you've taken the trouble to acquire a serious trade, preferably something you do with your hands as well as your mind. IT and computer hardware guys are great, the party needs them, but if you're an electrician or a plumber or a registered nurse, or for that matter anything in the medical profession, and you're willing to take care of old people, pack that U-Haul trailer right now. I can tell you flat out, if you have a serious marketable skill set like that, you will still be hired at the first place you walk in the door, in Seattle or Kalispell or anywhere else in the Northwest. There are a lot of serious employers up here who, in their heart of hearts, and out of long experience, do not want to hire Mexicans, and who will go out of their way not to do so as long as they can keep it covert and not be openly accused of racism. If you're white, male, American, and you show up on an employer's door with a viable skill set, some kind of paper to back it up, a good work record, and above all, a good attitude, you will be amazed at how much some employers are willing to overlook in order not to have a bunch of wetbacks in their workplace. You will eventually get something up here. It may not be Dilbert in a cubicle pulling down $75,000 per year, but you can do it. Even if you've got some useless degree like history or political science, even if you've got a criminal record, there is still enough economic vitality left in a city the size of Seattle so that if you hustle like hell, you can get something. You can still get a job here if you are intelligent, presentable, and you have some kind of resume to show, but it'll come with a cost. You have to play the game. You have to be willing to compete with locals. You will need to bring a properly pressed suit for interviews and a pair of shoes that will take a shine. You will need to cut your hair and trim your beard and mustache, wash your face, and conceal any tattoos beneath a long-sleeved shirt or blouse. You must be prepared to say, yes, sir, no, sir, three bags full, sir. Or, more likely, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, three bags full, ma'am. If you are willing to play the game and you have something, anything to offer, you will eventually be able to get a job here. Okay, first music break. We've had some pretty racist music on here so far, but now I think it's time for some male chauvinism. If you watch TV or movies, one of the things I'm sure you've noticed is that Hollywood violence against men, almost entirely against white men, on the part of karate-kicking women and female military commandos and so-called warrior babes with swords and armored bikinis, is now a staple of the entertainment industry. The idea is to present white males as weak and lame in every department, fumbling cowards and figures of fun who are routinely beaten up on by girls, especially girls and women who kick them in the testicles and otherwise damage male sexual organs and sexually humiliate them. The message here is not subtle. The fact is, of course, that feminists do have a bit of a point in that in real life, most intergender violence among all races is in fact committed by men against women and always will be. The real-life fact is that men are larger and stronger and more violent than women, and in any kind of straight-up contest, the man will usually win. I say usually. Not always, but enough so you can generalize. In actual practice, any woman who tries to use karate moves or any of that Hollywood horseshit on a serious and motivated male attacker is going to be very badly hurt, unless she really, really knows what she's doing, or else she catches the guy by surprise and sucker kicks him in the nuts. Which is absolutely fine if she's fighting off a rape attempt or something like that, although the best way to do that is simply for her to carry a gun and know how to use it. But I'm sure all of you have noticed these movies like Kill Bill or There's Something About Mary, and there was a country song a while ago by the Dixie Chicks, I think, about some woman carving up her husband or boyfriend and driving around with his parts in the trunk, this kind of stuff. Female revenge fantasies. When women do that kind of thing, it's considered humor and entertainment, but if men sang about killing and hurting women and their revenge fantasies like that, I think we all know what would happen. But wait a minute. Sometimes we do. This is the Country Gentleman with River Bottom.
Take me down to that river bottom, boys. Let me loaf around and take my time. Let me look at that place where I last saw her face. Let me sit down and think about my crime, boys. What I done to that pretty gal of mine. Well, that sheriff's coming, I don't care. His bloodhounds are sucking up the air. They're coming after a while to make me walk that last mile. But I ain't gonna cry, gonna smile. 'Cause it made me feel so good to see her die. Take me down to that river bottom, boys. Let me walk along that shady river lane. Let me stand once again where she took 100 men, where I first felt the squeeze of her chain, boys. Used to laugh at me when I was in pain. Oh, that holy angel and her dream, with that big ugly devil neath the skin. She was shy, she was bold, sweet warm I've been told. Now her hot body flows in the cold, and her gold slips among the sugar cane. Last night I dreamed I was there, looking down at her face, pale and fair, with the red eyes and blue gills swimming and weeping all through her long streaming hair. Take me down that river bottom, boys. Let me loaf around and take my ease. Let me sit on that stump where she took that long jump, with my clothesline tied around her knees, boys. Cheating hands and clutching at the breeze, where she went straight down to her death, with that cussing and whiskey on her breath. And them lies from before couldn't help her anymore, and I laughed just to see her singing low. Just to know I'll put an end to that disease. Just to know I'll put an end to that disease.
I think we're going to start a new feature here on Radio Free Northwest, and I'm going to call it Harold's Advice Column for White Nationalists. This is just what it sounds like, advice. It's not some kind of hard and fast ideology. I'm not saying that everybody absolutely has to follow my wonderful, inspired guidance, or I'll cast you into utter darkness, nothing like that. I'm simply going to make periodic comments based on the fact that I've been involved in this goo-boo zoo for over 42 years now, if you date my involvement from the 1968 Wallace for President campaign and my time in Chapel Hill High School, or 38 years if you date my involvement from the Franklin Road NSWPP. Either way, that's a long time. During that time, I've racked up enough practical experience in movement matters to give you guys some pointers, which you may take or leave as you choose. For my first piece of advice, I'm going to repeat something I've offered in the past to young white people, along with my advice to learn a trade and a marketable skill. This especially applies to would-be skinheads. I think it's a sufficiently important topic to deserve comment, and I hope readers who know skins or serving members of the military will make a special point to pass this podcast on to them. My advice is this: do not deface your body with tattoos. Never mind Kiki McGee and Jimmy Wingo in the Brigade. That was fiction. This is the real world. My objections are not artistic or aesthetic, although sometimes I wonder what all these hot chicks with their barbed wire and artsy ink are going to look like when they're 65. I know that tattooing is an ancient art form and was practiced by our own primordial ancestors as well as others, but we are not ancient Celts or Scythians. Tattooing has become a kind of a fad among many young white people, mostly boys, but some girls as well. Some of these kids get tattoos of an overt racial design, but they don't fully realize that these cool decorations can cause all kinds of problems in later life. First off, there is the very practical objection that a tattoo is a permanent identifying mark and one of the main things listed on any police description or wanted circular. The obvious application here is to anyone who wants to be a genuine revolutionary in the future, but it's not a good idea in any case. It is a sad fact that a white man no longer need be a criminal to get in trouble with our master's law nowadays. You can find yourself on the run from the law in a heartbeat over some stupid incident that's genuinely not your fault. But because a nigger or a Mexican or a faggot is involved and you have a white skin, you're the one who's headed to prison. In a society where black and brown predators roam at large, even a simple trip to the grocery store can turn into an unending nightmare from which you never wake up, asked George David Lube. It's terrifying how easily a white man or woman's life can be destroyed in so many different ways by some chance encounter with a nigger or a wetback, either through death or maiming as a crime victim or because one refuses to become a passive victim. A man is forced to defend himself or his family, and all of a sudden he finds that he's the bad guy, a criminal, a wanted fugitive. It's like the Michael Douglas character in that movie Falling Down. An ordinary white man leaves his house in the morning looking to buy his daughter a present for a birthday party, and he ends up that night standing on a pier with a smoking gun in his hand in stunned disbelief, asking, "How did I get to be the bad guy? How did that happen?" Don't think it can't happen in real life, ask Carl Hand. There is also the consideration that someday our kind of politics is going to get serious, and you may well find yourself on the run on political or resistance-related charges. If it ever happens to you, either accidentally or because you chose to resist the agenda, you don't want to end up like Joseph Paul Franklin, who stopped by an emergency room to get a cut treated and had a nurse drop a dime on him when she recognized his tattoos. Finally, there's an even stronger reason for avoiding tattoos. Most white kids get their skinhead or white power tattoos when they're young and wild, when the possibility that they may ever become 25 or 30 seems impossibly remote. But trust me, guys, it happens to the best of us. Someday, you will leave the military or the skin scene or whatever youth scene you're into, and it's going to get old, and you will want to let your hair grow, get a job, get a home, get married, and start taking adult responsibilities. Believe me, you will. None of which will be easy if your arms and shoulders are covered with racially explicit tattoos. Colorful skulls and Viking maidens and swastikas do not impress potential employers, wives, or in-laws. Don't carelessly do something now which will make you 17 years old forever. Okay, second bit of advice for white nationalists. Do not avoid or try to downplay Holocaust revisionism. I mention this because I was in a chat room a while back, and one of our comrades was suggesting that the Northwest Front needs to avoid revisionism because it might make us look like Nazis. Well, got a hot flash for you folks. A lot of us are Nazis, including me. But there are very sound reasons why Holocaust revisionism needs to be part of any serious white resistance movement. The occupying power that we're fighting against in the Northwest is, of course, the United States, but it's also something which we can delineate by the admittedly vague designation, the Jews, or perhaps New World Order. The so-called Holocaust is the bedrock foundation, virtually the entire moral capital of the New World Order. It is the basis and justification in one form or another for almost every action that liberal democracy has undertaken in the past half century against Western culture and nations and people who attempt to uphold that heritage. It is also a seemingly bottomless gold mine in the form of so-called reparations, which has financed murderous Israeli aggression in the Middle East and numerous anti-white Jewish institutions and projects the world over. It is now a multi-billion dollar annual industry which shores up much of world Zionism and liberalism. It is a prop that has to be knocked from under world Jewry's sagging and weakening structure. Take away the Holocaust, and what do you have left? Without their precious Holocaust, what are the Jews? Just a grubby little bunch of international bandits and assassins and squatters who have perpetrated the most massive, cynical fraud in human history. Once the world at large becomes aware of the way that we've all been lied to and deceived from birth about the causes, events, and responsibility for World War II, the Jews' days of lording it over the earth are numbered. For all the immense amount of time and money and effort the Holocaust industries put in and will continue to expend in order to perpetuate the hoax, they're on the losing end of history. For one thing, the whole issue is of growing irrelevance to the masses of today's white Americans and Canadians. Everyday people are worried about making ends meet, whether they'll have a job tomorrow or next week, paying the mortgage so their house doesn't get foreclosed, putting food on the table in a time of growing inflation, and whether they're going to get sick and end up with $50,000 in medical bills. They're worried about whether they're going to walk into their workplace tomorrow and find that they've been downsized, that their promotion or raise has been taken by an unqualified woman or minority under affirmative action, or whether the whole plant's closing down and moving to Mexico or Taiwan. They're worried about whether their son or daughter's going to get into college because of the racial quotas. They're worried about whether their younger children are going to be sodomized in school by homosexual teachers or whether they'll even learn to read. The average white family today lives in a constant state of desperation and apprehension and stress. People simply don't have the time to worry about regurgitated 70-year-old propaganda from a war most people don't even remember. Let's be frank, who really gives a damn about World War II anymore besides Jews? As far as my own personal beliefs go, I've examined the evidence and I've spoken to men who were there on both sides. Everybody from a former British sergeant who was with the so-called liberating forces to former German SS veterans and civilians. I always found the whole idea a bit hard to swallow. Even as a child reading my first books about the war, even then it struck me as such an illogical thing for the Germans to do while they were fighting a war for their survival. For whatever my opinion matters, I'm now personally convinced that nothing resembling the official version of the Holocaust occurred. If nothing else, the David Cole video on Auschwitz would be enough to clinch it. One look at the interior of the so-called gas chamber, complete with skylights, is enough to make any rational person realize that the entire story is a fraud. But let me say this, if the Simon Wiesenthal Center or anybody else were to produce for me absolutely irrefutable proof that the whole Holocaust did in fact occur exactly as advertised, it wouldn't make a damn bit of difference to me or cause me to alter my National Socialist faith one iota. In fact, in view of the Allied bombs and what they did to Dresden and Cologne and Hamburg, in view of what the Germans and the captive nations suffered under Stalin, I think it would probably cheer me up to think that at least some of those reptiles in human form who caused it all got theirs. Second music break. Last week we were talking about themes from the Northwest novels and theme music for my characters and whatnot, and I got a request from Shaun of the Dead, as this particular comrade calls himself, asking for me to pretend that the brigade is being made into a movie and for me to pick and play a theme for the Oscar Night Massacre, kind of music to slaughter Jews by. I thought about this one, and I think I've got just the number. This is the Finnish group Korpiklaani. Not sure if Korpiklaani is officially black metal or what, but that was called Wooden Pints, and I can imagine a lot of Jews being slaughtered to that groovy sound. This email is from April Gady. Dear HAC, I wonder if coming out as an organization is wise at this time, especially when they're going to try and link everyone together with some sort of RICO thing. Okay, let me get into the whole concept of the Northwest Front and how I envision our future. Although in my email rants and in our literature I speak of the party as a matter of convenience and also as a reference to the Northwest novels, when we were starting out back in the fall of 2008, I deliberately chose the name Front rather than Party for our effort because that's more descriptive of what we will eventually be. We must actually move towards independence across a whole wide spectrum of strategies, tactics, events, and historical developments. A whole front, if you want to use the military terminology, with innumerable little actions going on all up and down the line. The late Pastor Robert Miles described our future successful white resistance movement as a number of columns that march separately but strike together. And this is what we're going to have to build. We cannot attempt to create a formal Rotary Club-style organization with a president and a secretary and a treasurer and a chief cook and bottle washer. Groups like that either get bogged down in democracy and rules and procedures and they never become effective at all, or else they do become effective for a bit and then they self-destruct, either through infiltration or, more often, through the kind of ego and character problems that our movement has always had, exacerbated, of course, by democracy. I will say this, I cannot bring to mind one single major white racial political group that was destroyed solely by FBI infiltration or federal prosecution. Our groups are always, let me repeat that, always destroyed from within when the leadership becomes corrupted. We simply do not seem to be able to summon the necessary strength of character and the necessary strength of will in order to create and maintain an actual political organization. Let's be brutally honest here. The 1990s and early 2000s National Alliance under the late Dr. William Pierce was probably the best we will ever be able to do as far as formal organization goes, and that's because Pierce had the necessary infrastructure. Pierce had land and buildings and plant, and above all, Pierce had the money, actually, to employ people. Never mind where he originally got that money from. Suffice it to say, he got it, and he was allowed to keep it, and he had sufficient business acumen to turn the National Alliance into what was probably the only actual organization our movement has had since the old NSWPP and NSPA in the early 80s. William Pierce actually signed paychecks, and in America, that's what makes someone boss. I bitch and moan and groan about nobody in the movement being willing to do anything, but I should clarify that. What I mean is that nobody is willing to do anything purely because it is right. Once any real money enters the equation, all of a sudden our people got a whole new attitude. Americans are completely materialistic, they're motivated entirely by money, and the National Alliance and the old NSWPP are proof that it is indeed possible for the white race to get a full and honest day's revolutionary work out of so-called white nationalists, if they are paid. The problem is that we in the Northwest Front have no money. I haven't been able to persuade most of the people listening to this even to kick in $10 a month dues. Now, the result is that we can't pay anyone to do the right thing, ergo, the right thing doesn't get done. Same thing with the physical act of Northwest migration. If we could actually offer people some kind of party job with a salary and an apartment or a house to live in or even an Aryan Nation-style bunkhouse, as soon as the word percolated through the movement that there was money and goodies available, we'd be overrun with more Northwest migrants than we could handle. The great challenge that the Northwest Front faces is to get American white people of the 21st century to do the same thing because it is right that they would do without hesitation if they were paid to do for their people what they would immediately do for cash. Now, this is why we have to change our character. This is why that as an act of will, we must voluntarily renounce the material things of this world and replace the false golden idols of Judaism with the true things of the Spirit. The Northwest Imperative is an idea, not an idea that I in any way made up or invented. I certainly don't claim credit for it, and I'm simply an exponent of that idea. I'm not some kind of guru. The Northwest Front must become an organism, not an organization. And I think about now we need a third music break. Something Gaelic but not Irish, I think. This is The Sound of Tarrancy by the Tannehill Weavers. Thank you. I just refer to the Northwest Front as an organism and not an organization. However, and let me choose my words carefully here, every organism must have a heart and a brain. Within this organism, this front, this broad, larger movement, this big tent, whatever you want to call it, there must be a small core of absolutely dedicated activists, true political soldiers like they had in Europe back in the 1920s, people who are in fact under party discipline and organized into active cells or teams. They will always be in the minority, very much so, because they will be the first genuine Aryan racial elite since 1945. I envision this inner circle or core group in my mind as the beginnings of the real-life NVA. In fact, I refer to them in my own thoughts as Northwest Volunteers, complete with a secret oath of allegiance to the Republic, which will probably be illegal somewhere under the Patriot Act. In terms of function and influence and presence, the Northwest Volunteers will be to the Northwest Front what a made man in the mafia is. They will be the ones who run the crews and the ones who give orders and the ones who obey orders, because they will be genuine soldiers. Again, something which our movement hasn't seen since 1945. And before everyone comes running to me by email saying, "I want to be a Northwest Volunteer. I want to be a Northwest Volunteer, Harold. Oh, wow, let me in your club, Harold." I want to say flat out that no such group exists and will not exist for a long, long time, because we simply don't have the human material for it. We have a few people in the NF I would consider as candidates for such an order or core group of Northwest Volunteers, but so few that there isn't even any point in talking about it right now. If and when we do this, we're going to be doing it for real, and we don't dare screw it up by jumping the gun and turning it into some kind of comic opera little club. Part and parcel of the Northwest Volunteers' ideology must be an iron personal discipline, which will not be a burden but his or her greatest pride. The Northwest Volunteer must live for one thing and one thing only, the Northwest American Republic. There must be voluntary renunciation of the material things and pleasures of this world. Money, property, houses, cars, high-tech toys, booze and drugs, promiscuous and casual sex, and above all, the luxury of living only for ourselves. Now you see why I say that right now the Northwest Volunteers are a fantasy. I won't say that it's impossible to find 1,000 white Americans who are willing to do what I just said and live as I've just described. There are. I'm sure that there are 1,000 white men and women out there like that somewhere. But we haven't found them yet, and at the rate we're going, that's nowhere on the horizon. One reason we need to learn to renounce and avoid the accumulation of material things is the simple and practical one that if we own anything, Morris Dees will eventually steal it from us in a malicious and abusive lawsuit. Morris loves to find a racist who has a house and land he can seize and give it to some nigger, so he can wave it aloft like a trophy for his mailing list of donors and say, "See what we did to the wicked Klansman or neo-Nazi or whatever. Now send me all kinds of money so I can keep on robbing and humiliating these white people that you hate so much." Morris Dees does indeed make his living off hate. His own hate and the hatred of Jews and non-whites for the white man who made this world and created the Western civilization that so clearly demonstrates these other people's inferiority. But mostly, we have to renounce the material things of this world and the wealth of the Jews, because these are what white Americans have been conditioned all our lives to desire above all things. And they are accordingly what the Jew uses to control our behavior and even to control our thoughts. We have to accept the reality that the Iron Dream and the American Dream are simply not compatible, and that the middle-class American lifestyle, if it is still ever to be possible at all, is only possible at the cost of everything in us that remains decent and good. The price of the American Dream is too high, and it always was. In medieval times, there were legends of men and women who sold their souls to the devil, usually in exchange for worldly treasures such as gold and silver and jewels, sometimes for fame, often for power, sometimes for sex in the form of a particular man or woman, such as Gretchen in the story of Faust. I can't think of any closer parallel to the bargain that the Jews have offered our people over the last century. They gave us the split-level ranch house in the suburbs and the backyard barbecue and the Brady Bunch lifestyle in exchange for the surrender of all within us that was immortal and eternal. But like the devil's gold that turns to slate in the light of noon, the Jews can no longer provide the money and the luxury and the house in the suburbs and the whole nine yards. Instead of the Brady Bunch, we're headed towards Soylent Green. Can the white people of America reclaim their immortal part from the claws of the kikes? Or more specifically, will I be able to find 1,000 Northwest volunteers who can reclaim their souls and harden their hearts and discipline their minds to do what has to be done? Just 1,000 men and women, that's all it'll take. Will we be able to find them in time? We'll see how that plays out. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha and Ninban. Freedom.